This week, we're back with part 7 of Whither Are We Traveling? Brother Darren A. Laners gives his generational outlook on the question of whether America's passion for bigness and efficiency has ruined Masonic charity. Why do we as Americans need to be acknowledged for our charitable efforts? Doesn't looking for acknowledgement stray from the path of altruism? Then a staple of romanticized Freemasonry. The Lodge over Simpkins Store, an original poem written by Most Worshipful Lawrence N. Greenleaf for the Grand Lodge of Colorado. Some say it was a real place. Brother Patrick Day takes on the Lodge over Simpkins Store in this week's Masonic Mythbusters. Finally, we'll wrap it up with a discussion around the Ace of Pentacles. As a tarot card, what does it mean for you Masonically? What does it mean for you in your personal life? Does its prescribed meanings give rise to thoughts in your own mind about future opportunities? All this and more. Stay tuned.
Welcome back to Whence Came You, a Masonic podcast featuring research papers and discussions related to Freemasonry. Here's your host, Brother Robert Johnson.
All right, welcome back. This is episode number 536. Right away, let's thank the contributors, the fellows, the producers, and legacy partners of the Whence Came You podcast. We've been bringing this show to you since July of 2011. Almost 11 years, you guys. This is an incredible endeavor. It takes time to put into it, and, you know, I just have to say thank you to these people who make this show possible. I could not do it without you, and so to all of you, I want to say thank you as always. And if you're curious on how you can help this podcast, head on over to WCYpodcast.com and click on Support the Show. Feel free to click around on the website. We've got lots of really cool, interesting things, some Easter eggs and little places. Explore. You'll find something, I'm sure, that interests you and that you'll find edifying. Well, if I sound a little different, I caught a head cold. Ah, man. It seems so weird to get sick these days because I feel like I didn't get sick for 2.5 years because we were masked up and I didn't leave the house very much, and now I got the smallest head cold, and I just feel, well, not terrible, but you almost forget what it's like to be sick. But anyway, that aside, I wanted to go ahead and let you guys know a couple of the upcoming presentations. I'll be doing a virtual presentation, The Legend of Adam's Grave, on March 21st, so just here in a week or so, and then on April 30th, I'll be doing an in-person event over at Sequoit Masonic Lodge, number 827, at 6 p.m. I'll be doing Esoterics 101, and of course a table lodge on the 20th of April as well, where I'll be doing a keynote on the Worldwide Brotherhood of the Masonic Fraternity. You're no doubt excited or maybe even triggered by the intro to the show. So, I want to get into the education for this week, and then we'll get right into the Masonic Mythbusters with Brother Patrick Day. So, let's go ahead and check this out. The first piece this week is Whither Are We Traveling? Part 7 by Worshipful Brother Darren A. Laners. As we continue to explore Dwight L. Smith's seminal work, Whither Are We Traveling?, we begin to explore his answers to the 10 questions he posed for self-examination of the state of ancient craft Freemasonry in 1963. The questions he asked are as important and relevant now as they were then. This week, we look at question 6. Has the American passion for bigness and efficiency dulled the spirit of Masonic charity? Now, when I first read this title, you kind of don't know what they're talking about. You know, Masonic charity, what does that mean? Are we doing enough charity? Is that what they're talking about? Well, let's read on. Most Worshipful Brother Smith begins this section by giving an example of how, in asking an average Mason, in his case of being from Indiana, he says, "Who's your Mason?" about Masonic charity, you'll receive the list of the organized institutional charities that each Grand Lodge and Masonic appendant bodies have created. He then goes on to state that when pushed to describe it at the lodge level, when asked about what he is doing personally, he might give you various examples and will even produce all of the receipts from his own donations throughout the year that he will write off his tax deductions. When asked directly the question, quote, "How long has it been since you went on foot and out of your way to aid a needy brother?" the Mason might look astonished, but then pity the question asker for being insane. He then asks the question, what has happened to Masonic charity? And recalls a time when it was one of the sweetest byproducts of the teachings of the craft. He recalls a time when, while reading the minutes of his mother lodge, he read about the brethren getting together and building a modest home for one of the Masonic widows, and another when they donated a cord of wood to a widow of a man who was not a Mason. He states that there was a time when such acts were common. He laments that they are now rare, but that when they do happen, the impact upon the recipient of the charity is tremendous. He gives two reasons as to why he feels they are now rare. One, the American need for acknowledgement of charitable efforts. Instead of being content with quiet, selfless acts of charity, we instead want to advertise our giving and be acknowledged for it. We want plaques to hang up on the walls telling us how great we are for giving to those who are less fortunate. And two, Freemasonry does things the hard way when it's working properly. However, we no longer want to undertake the charitable efforts of our ancestors. Instead of pitching in to build a widow a home, we'd rather just write her a check. He then goes on to say that he is not attacking Masonic charities, but rather the laziness, the complacency, the lack of vision with which we pour great sums of money into organized benevolences, and then, with self-righteous congratulations to ourselves, let it go at that. He then asks the following, wherein do we fall short? Let's look in the mirror. 1. Is it worth mentioning? How often do we hear the master call for reports of sickness at the meeting of the lodge? In how many Masonic halls is the box of fraternal assistance passed? In how many halls could such a box be found? 2. Do we remember? How often are the members of a lodge called upon to assist in person in some act of true Masonic charity? Are they ever asked to visit the sick? Or is that assignment turned over to a retired brother who has nothing else to do? How many years can go by without a Master Mason giving of himself in an act of benevolence or charity or brotherhood? 3. Are we interested? In far too many lodges, the payment of the annual per capita tax to the Grand Lodge is looked upon as the full discharge of all obligations pertaining to charity, an act which relieves every individual member of further concern for the year ending December 31st. When I say that, unfortunately, I am not merely engaging in rhetoric. I am speaking of an actual fact. 4. First things last? In far too many lodges, even the easy expedient of soliciting voluntary contributions for the Masonic home is pushed aside as something of a minor importance if there is a new temple to build or pay for. Self-indulgence comes at the head of the list. 5. Crumbs from the table? Each lodge in Indiana is required to have a relief fund, but how much? I am ashamed to have the minimum figure seen in print. It is such a paltry sum that it could hardly do more than buy an occasional cup of coffee for a street beggar. The minimum should be 20 times its present amount. Instead of addressing each question, I will just say this. While I agree with most Worshipful Brother Smith's questioning of our individual efforts of charity as Freemasons, I do want to state that I do not agree that the Masonic charities of my Grand Lodge are being done just to give self-righteous congratulations to itself. I do believe they do amazing work to help brethren and their families, as well as the widows and Masonic orphans in my grand jurisdiction of Illinois. His main point is, I believe, is that we as individual Masons have neglected our duty to look after each other. In the current world, where we are surrounded by distractions at every turn and being bombarded by information, I will be the first to admit that I often do not practice this form of Masonic charity as much as I should. As a lodge, we are often discussing brethren that are suffering from hardship, and we are doing what we can to relieve them. However, am I doing enough individually to reach out to them? I have not. I have no excuse for this other than I am one of the Masons that most Worshipful Brother Smith is right to point his finger at. I acknowledge I have to do a better job of this, as do many other of my brothers. Maybe you're one of these brothers, like me, or maybe not. However, in the amount of time that we spend on frivolous pursuits like social media, could we not be checking in on our brothers? Think about how much time you spend mindlessly scrolling each week, and then think about what else you could have done with that time. Are we using our 24-inch gauge wisely I personally can say that I make a concerted effort to try and stay off of social media, but it still probably accounts for more than a couple of hours per week. This is time that I could be using to practice the charity that most worshipful Brother Smith speaks of. He goes on to say, quote, "But there is another side to the coin. Let's look at that side for a moment. One, given the challenge to practice Masonic charity in its intimate and personal form, almost any lodge and almost any individual Mason will respond with enthusiasm. More important, Freemasonry will then come to have a new meaning for them. A few years ago, the Grand Master of Missouri, distressed by the perfunctory manner in which the charity obligation is discharged, set out on a campaign to encourage lodges to perform their own acts of charity. Voluntary acts. Impulsive acts. Without organization, without advanced planning. He asked each lodge to send him a written report of what it had done. I read many of those reports, but not without a lump in my throat. And not only in Missouri can it happen. Right here in Indiana, I have seen glorious examples of Masonic charity. For example, the story of one small lodge which came face to face with a staggering obligation, and of how the brethren responded to their everlasting credit. 2. Any lodge, large or small, which experiences the joy of giving of itself in a truly personal act of charity, discovers that it literally has been born again. Once I heard the senior warden of a large lodge, describe the distress in the home of a widow of a deceased brother who was making a brave struggle to hold her family together. It is not often we have calls for relief, he said. Now this is our opportunity. Significantly, that lodge is not losing in membership and has no attendance problems. A past master of a small lodge, which levied an assessment to meet a relief emergency, sat in my office and declared, quote, "That incident was the best thing that has happened to our lodge in the 40 years I have been a Mason, for until then, most of us had no clear idea of the true meaning of Masonry." End quote. What does it all add up to? Well, for me, it adds up to this. We are missing a golden opportunity for a great Masonic Renaissance when we continue to let our American passion for bigness and efficiency dull the spirit of true Masonic charity. There simply is no substitute for the personal touch on the local level, where it counts. Don't tell me how many hundreds of thousands of dollars Freemasons contribute annually to organized benevolent projects. That is not the question at stake. And don't give me the old excuse that lodges are prohibited from using their funds for purposes not Masonic. That, too, is avoiding the issue. Freemasonry, if it operates as such, is a relationship with individuals, and I insist on talking about the personal efforts of lodges and individual Master Masons. I want to know what individual Masons are doing to relieve distress in their own communities by their own effort. Whenever lodge is opened and whenever it is closed, the senior warden tells the master why he was induced to become a Master Mason. One of those reasons he offers is that he might contribute to the relief of poor, distressed Master Masons, their widows and orphans. Lip service? Sounding brass and a tinkling cymbal? Not unless we make it so. The brethren are here. They are as generous and kindly and thoughtful as they ever were. It is up to us to give them the occasion to do what they have obligated themselves to do. Given that opportunity, Master Masons will respond in such a manner that the revival of Freemasonry will no longer be a fond hope. It will be here and now. What Dwight is stating is that when lodges or Masons are given the opportunity to do their own acts of charity, not only do they respond in kind, it often energizes the lodge. I feel that he believes that what complicates these efforts is that we have a wonderful and benevolent charity organization at the Grand Lodge, which is fulfilling this role. However, he believes that if given the opportunity to practice relief, that the individual lodges and brethren would rise to the challenge. While I do agree that when given the opportunity, individual lodges would rise to the challenge, I don't believe that it's an either-or scenario. What needs to be happening is a partnership between individual lodges and the charities to contribute to this relief. Maybe the programs that were available in most Worshipful Brother Smith's time were not as robust as the ones that we currently have. This, I do not know. However, I do know that, at least here in Illinois, I am extremely proud to extol the great work that they do to help our brethren, widows, and orphans, as well as children in our communities. Many of the programs that IMOS, MCAP, and MSAP, the Illinois Masonic Outreach Program, Illinois Masonic Children's Assistance Program, and Illinois Masonic Student Assistance Program provide often are programs that are too expensive or difficult for individual lodges to undertake by themselves. So, while I do believe that we should absolutely do more at the local lodge level to assist our brethren, widows and orphans that are distressed, I also think that without the Grand Lodge programs, there would be more of our brethren going without, as individual lodges would not be able to shoulder this burden of relief on their own. In my next article, I'll explore the next question most worshipful Brother Smith poses, which is, Question 7, do we pay enough attention to the festive board? Darren A. Laners, Past Master. Certainly, I have thought about this quite a bit, and what I've come across, or what I've come through thinking about at the end, is always that it kind of comes down to this idea that we think that the Grand Lodge handles the charity so we don't have to, and that our responsibility as Masons is simply to watch and observe, and if we find a person who needs relief, then we just report it and move along with our day. And that's probably good, but it's not enough. Just actual things that you're doing with your own money and your own self on behalf of the lodge or some members that truly make the difference in other people's lives. And that's what people kind of remember with Freemasonry. Bill Hosler writes a lot about this in several of his articles that have been published on the Midnight Freemasons. My question for the Craftsman Plus is, tell me about a time that your lodge did something for the community or a widow and orphan. Be anonymous about it. You don't have to tell them, you don't have to say their name or, you know, all the nitty-gritty detail, but tell us about a time your lodge did something along the lines of what most worshipful Brother Smith is talking about here. I'll be glad to share my own. Now let's get into the segment you've been waiting for.
In a digital landscape filled with historical inaccuracy, out-of-context quotes on memes and soundbites, there is an epidemic of fraternal occult, mythological, and historical misinformation. It's time to set the record straight. Masonic Mythbusters with Patrick Day.
The Lodge Room over Simpkins' Store by Lawrence N. Greenleaf, published in the Square and Compass magazine, December 1898. The plainest lodge room in the land was over Simpkins' Store, where Friendship Lodge had met each month for 50 years or more, when o'er the earth the moon full-orbed had cast her brightest beams. The brethren came from miles around on horseback and in teams, and oh, what hearty grasp of hand would welcome met them there, as mingling from the waiting groups they slowly mount the stair, exchanging fragmentary news or prophecies of crop, until they reach the Tyler's room and current topics drop, to turn their thoughts to nobler themes they cherish and adore, and which were heard on meeting night up over Simpkins' Store. To city eyes a cheerless room long usage had defaced, the telltale lines of lath and beam on wall and ceiling traced. The light from oil-fed lamps was dim and yellow in its hue. The carpet once could pattern boast, though now 'twas lost to view. The altar and the pedestals that marked the station's three, the gatepost pillars topped with balls, the rude carved letter G, were village joiners' clumsy work. Many things beside, where beauty's lines were all effaced and ornament denied. There could be left no lingering doubt, if doubt there was before, the plainest lodge room in the land was over Simpkins' Store. While musing thus on outward form, the meeting time drew near, and we had glimpsed the inner life through watchful eye and ear. When lodge convened at gavel sound with officers in place, we looked for strange conglomerate work but could no errors trace. The more we saw, the more we heard, the greater our amaze. To find those country brethren there so skilled in mason's ways. But greater marvels were to come before the night was through, where unity was not mere name, but fell on heart like dew. Where tenets had the mind imbued, and truth's rich fruitage bore, and plainest lodge room in the land up over Simpkins' store. To hear the record of their acts was music to the ear. We sing of deeds unwritten, which on angel's scroll appear. A widow's case, four helpless ones, lodge funds were running low. A dozen brethren sprang to feet, and offers were not slow. Food, raiment, things needful sort, while one gave load of wood, another shoes for little ones, for each gave what he could. Then spake the last, I haven't things like these to give, but then some ready money may help out, and he laid down a 10. Where brothers cast on darkest square upon life's checkered floor, a beacon of light to reach the white was over Simpkins' store. Like scoffer who remained to pray, impressed by sight and sound, the faded carpet beneath our feet was now like holy ground. The walls that had such dingy look were turned celestial blue, the ceiling changed to canopy, where stars were shining through. Bright tongues of flame from altar leaped, the G was vivid blaze. All common things seemed glorified by heaven's reflected rays. Oh, wondrous transformation wrought through ministry of love. Behold, the lodge room beautiful, fair type of that above. The vision fades, the lesson lives, and taught as ne'er before. The plainest lodge room in the land, up over Simpkins' store. You probably have seen this poem. It is a very well-known poem for whatever reason. There are a few reasons why it is so well-known amongst Masons, but given how little else Greenleaf wrote is known, it's curious that this poem in particular became what he is largely remembered for. Now, Greenleaf was Grand Master of Colorado, and the poem, this poem, is published in the back of every clear text key published by the Grand Lodge of Colorado, as well as Colorado Craftsman. In 1991, during the Scottish Rite Bicentennial, the Supreme Council commissioned Robert Soulé to paint a reconstruction of the Simpkins' store and the lodge room, which was printed with a copy of the poem and a nicely framed displays that were sold in limited numbers. These are commonly seen in lodges throughout Colorado, but also in many lodges and Scottish Rite consistories across the United States. The poem was first distributed in the Square and Compass magazine, which was a magazine that was owned, published, and edited by Greenleaf himself. He chaired the Grand Lodge Committee on Foreign Correspondences for many years, and under his authority on this committee, he frequently would include a poem to illustrate a point he was trying to make in these correspondences with other Grand Lodges. This poem, The Lodge Room Over Simpkins' Store, was distributed to illustrate the charity Masons should dispense at this time when questions were arising between jurisdictions concerning whether to suspend a brother for non-payment of dues when he falls on hard times, especially in old age, and especially if he has otherwise always been an active member and paid his dues. So, Greenleaf writes this poem, and he distributes it in his correspondences, and it is a very popular and well-known poem that many Masons are familiar with for this reason. Now, that backstory aside, the million-dollar question is this a real lodge? No. In short, no, it's not. This is not a real lodge. There are several clues that Greenleaf gives us that indicates that this is not a real lodge, no matter how much they try and convince you down in South Park City that this is a real lodge room of this poem. Yet there are some that are convinced that Greenleaf was inspired by a real lodge, and I'm sure he was inspired by a real lodge. That is, every lodge that exemplifies the tenets of Freemasonry. Compassion for human suffering and the extension of charity, caring about each other, extending love and kindness to each other. Yeah, any lodge in any group of masons that holds these tenets, yeah, he was inspired by that. And some have actually proposed an exact lodge, a real lodge. Whether such holds merit or not is yet to be scrutinized, and we will take a look at that. Now, let's first dissect this poem, what it's about, what it indicates, that it is not a real lodge. There appears to be a number of synchronicities and similarity of names that create some confusion. I will acknowledge this, it does make it confusing, so bear with me. On the other hand, there's also this sheer will to want this lodge room to be a real place, and thus many now believe this was a real lodge. But it wasn't. So, there is a Simpkins store in Colorado. It is located in South Park City, which is on the south end of Fairplay, Colorado. However, South Park City is not a real town, it's a building museum. That is, it is a bunch of buildings from around the South Park region that were moved here to recreate the feel of an old mountain town. None of the buildings in South Park City actually belong there. They're not originally from there, that part of town, except for maybe like one. I think one is actually originally from the south end of Fairplay, while the rest really just come from all around the valley. Now, the vision of this building museum was first conceived by Leon H. Snyder, past Grand Master of Colorado Masons in 1961. He was an attorney from Colorado Springs. He liked to go fishing in the South Park area. And when he was out fishing, he became deeply acquainted with all the relics of the past that littered the valley and the surrounding mountains. He watched these structures, the machines, the mining equipment, all sorts of artifacts slowly degrade under the forces of the elements, as well as being destroyed by vandalism. He began to work very closely with Everett Baer, who's the unofficial sort of historian of the South Park Valley at the time. And in the summer of 1957, their dream was to become real. In 1957, the Fairplay Historical Foundation was established and a site was selected in Fairplay to build this building museum. Foundations were laid and professional movers were hired to begin relocating buildings from across the area to the site. On the centennial of the discovery of gold in the Pikes Peak region, 1959, the park was open to the public. It would appear, however, that Leon Snyder had one more big plan up his sleeve, the dedication of the lodge room over Simpkins' store. It was dedicated by the Grand Lodge of Colorado, with Leon Snyder acting as the senior grand warden on June 13, 1959. An exact replica of John Shivington's master's chair was donated to the building based on the actual chair in Golden Masonic Hall in Golden, Colorado. Now, lodges from around the state donated historical items and replicas to decorate the place with. It was so much invested into this lodge room, one has to ask, was it all a lie? Okay, well, maybe not a lie. A lie implicates that someone was trying to conceal the truth. But were they all confused or deceived? The building, after all, was called Simpkins Store. This is actually the name of the building. So this must be the one, right? Like, this has to be it. Strangely enough, it's not. Now, Greenlee penned this poem. He dates it November 19th, 1898. Yet the poem clearly states that the lodge of the poem, quote, had met each month for 50 years or more, end quote. This would place the dispensation of this lodge sometime in 1848, more than a decade before the Pikes Peak Gold Rush. In fact, it puts it back to the California Gold Rush. There were no settlements in Colorado at this time, except for, you know, indigenous American settlements. It's strange to fantasize what kind of town would exist all alone in the Rocky Mountains, and more so what kind of lodge would have been chartered there. It's not a lodge of any records of any Grand Lodge in any jurisdiction, especially Colorado. That is for certain. If it truly was a Masonic lodge out there in the lone wilderness of the western half of the Kansas Territory in 1848, then it was a clandestine lodge. Actually, no, wait. There was no Kansas Territory yet. Kansas Territory was established in 1854. Lord knows what could have actually been out there, much less a Masonic lodge. There is the possibility this was not a Colorado lodge that Greenleaf is writing about, which would make it even less certain where this lodge could be. Perhaps a lodge in Massachusetts, where Greenleaf was made a Mason. It certainly was not a lodge in Colorado, much less the one in the Simpkins store as it stands in South Park City. Next, Greenleaf tells us that this lodge is called Friendship Lodge. There actually was a Friendship Lodge in Colorado. It actually recently merged with Black Hawk Lodge 11 in January of 2017, but they did not receive dispensation until September 14, 1959, just a few months after the Simpkins store was dedicated by the Grand Lodge of Colorado. Which is intriguing to fantasize that Friendship Lodge number 185 was named after the lodge in this poem. However, the two names are ultimately unrelated. According to the official history of Friendship Lodge 185, they chose the name after the lodge of Vice Admiral Lord Horatio Nelson, who was a member of Friendship Lodge number 100, and who later called his flagship Friendship. Strangely enough, one of the chartering members of Friendship Lodge 185 was G.F. Bateman, who was also a member of Lawrence N. Greenleaf Lodge number 169. There's another wee bit of synchronicity there to make names a wee bit more confusing for you. Greenleaf, it would appear, simply chose the name Friendship to illustrate the charity and brotherly love to be found in this invented lodge of his own imagination. As mentioned, the buildings in South Park City come from around the area. Simpkins' store just so happened to have come from the ghost town of Dudley, which is just a few miles north of Alma, Colorado, probably the largest town you'll find on a map to indicate where Dudley was. It's entirely possible Greenleaf visited Dudley. In July of 1862, Greenleaf was on tour in the Rocky Mountains, giving entertainment to the workmen in the various mining camps, likely one of the first entertainment tours of its kind in the Rocky Mountains at this time. And he's usually reading his poem, King Sham, as well as other comical poems. Now, he writes a correspondence to the Rocky Mountain News to his good friend William Byers. Greenleaf is writing under the pen name Peter Punever, which is a pseudonym he used for his early comical writings. He relates to the Rocky Mountain News that he was in Montgomery, which today is also a ghost town, and it lies beneath the waters of Montgomery Reservoir. Now, Montgomery is little more than a stone's throw away from Dudley. However, he does not indicate or relate in any manner that he visited Dudley, nor in his later writings does he mention the town of Dudley and his list of destinations while he was on this tour. I mean, he could have passed through there and maybe even passed through the doors of the Simpkins store. He could have not, all the same. It would not have mattered anyway, as Greenleaf was not even made a Mason until 1863, a full year after his last known venture near Dudley. There's no record, either by his own hand or otherwise, that he ever visited Dudley, Colorado, ever. Period. All of it is total speculation. This does not matter even further, as there was no chartered lodge in Dudley, ever, nor in Montgomery, or Alma, or any other nearby town, except for Fairplay and Leadville. So even if Greenleaf was in Dudley at one time or another, there was no lodge there to visit, at least none that was authorized. If we really want to speculate that some lodge met here, we are treading into murky waters of Greenleaf visiting a clandestine lodge before he was even a Mason. Furthermore, if you've ever been to the lodge room of Simpkins' store in South Park City, it is very cramped and small. They tried to pick like the smallest chairs and altar and other furniture as possible, and it is still so cramped. I don't know how you'd would have a genuine Masonic meeting in such a place, much less confer a degree. They have held meetings in there, and it, I understand it was very difficult since there's just no room to move. It's hard to imagine how any lodge can actually function in that tiny space. Now, according to George Byers Clark, Greenleaf got his inspiration for this poem from a visit to Pueblo Lodge number 17, back when they still met on the upper floor of Snyder's drugstore. Leon Snyder, name not related, but just another bit of synchronicity I think is fascinating behind this. Clark had visited and transcribed a conversation he had had with Cornelius Hart, past Grandmaster, in 1877. Hart believed that Greenleaf was describing their old lodge room in Pueblo, which was simple and small and had nearly all the characteristics that Greenleaf describes in the poem. He cannot be entirely sure of it himself, but he felt it was so, or at least it was poetically true. In reality, this could really be any rural lodge. Rural lodges tend to be small and austere compared to their urban counterparts. Another clue that Greenleaf gives us is that the lodge meets on a full moon night. And he appears to be playing on an old rumor that lodges used to meet on full moon nights, the better to see while traveling at night. However, no lodges in Colorado have ever been chartered that were lunar lodges. I have heard that either Rocky Mountain Lodge or Summit Lodge, both were chartered from Nebraska, both of which are extinct and went extinct within a few years of being chartered. I've heard they were lunar lodges, but the bylaws or any records indicating such have never been recovered. At least not by the Grand Lodge of Colorado. If you do find this information, I am sure the Grand Lodge of Colorado would love to have you share it with them. As far as I'm aware, lunar lodges did not operate the way we think of them. We think they met on full moon nights, but this is hard to codify on a calendar. And if you ever come across the bylaws of a lunar lodge, it is usually stipulated that they meet on a day of the week after a full moon, such as like the Tuesday after the full moon. As far as I'm aware, in all my research, the only lunar lodge in Colorado was Pent Alpha Lodge number 5, which was part of Henry Bromwell's Rite of Free and Accepted Architects. All his architect lodges were lunar lodges, and they all met on a day of the week after the full moon. Okay. Let's recap. Greenleaf's lodge over Simpkins Store was called Friendship Lodge decades before Friendship Lodge was ever chartered, located in a town that never had an authorized lodge chartered over a decade before Colorado Gold Rush, and met on a full moon night of which no blue lodges in Colorado ever calendrically met on. More and more, it really feels like this just isn't a real lodge. Today, we do not seem to question whether or not this lodge room over Simpkins Store is real. We know there is a real place bearing this name, and that there is a historic recreation of a lodge room upstairs, with all those paintings with the poem framed and found in many Colorado Masonic halls. Why wouldn't we expect it to be real? Yet it's all a fantasy. I wouldn't say past Grandmaster Snyder duped everyone. I believe he genuinely wanted Greenleaf's lodge room over Simpkins Store to be real. Or he wanted to make it real. I think he wanted to call to everyone's attention the valuable lessons to be learned from the lodge room over Simpkins Store by making a place that is a tangible reminder. It's kind of like Disneyland. It's all fake, but it feels so real and therefore so magical. I think that's what Leon Snyder was doing. Somehow we lost sight of what he envisioned and just believed it was tangibly real. But as may be evidenced by the commentary from Julius Hart and the opinions of George Clark, clearly others have long believed that there was never an actual lodge that met in Dudley, Colorado in 1848, nor was it in the same building now located in South Park City. While Simpkins Store Lodge was never a real lodge, it is a real Masonic idea. There are lodges that are simple and small, and are also kind and benevolent. Those are real lodges, though they do not meet over Simpkin's store. They congregate elsewhere and have different names, but they are all lodges of friendship. Greenleaf's poem is not meant to be real, and certainly he knew he was describing a fictional lodge. But it is meant to become real, that every lodge should become Friendship Lodge, no matter what their meeting room looks like. All lodges are supposed to be generous and charitable. He gives us a parable to emulate, and not one to believe is tangible. Rather than being real, each lodge should strive to become that lodge that meets over Simpkin's store, which is not a geographical place, but a place of heart and mind and soul.
Another excellent segment by worshipful brother Patrick Day. I really enjoyed this one because I feel like in every lodge across America that I've visited has some homage to this particular lodge. What I find interesting, though, is that in my travels, I never really thought about this lodge as an actual place. It was always kind of a archetype for the small country lodge. It wasn't until much later did I realize that some felt this lodge was a real place. But it was wonderful to hear this awesome segment from Worshipful Brother Day. So one more time, if you guys see Brother Day out in the field, out in the quarries, as it were, doing his thing, spreading the light of Freemasonry, checking out his articles wherever they're published, including the Rocky Mountain Mason, let him know that you enjoy his work, and tell him thanks for all he does. All right, now it's time for the weekly reflection on the tarot card. This week, I'm going to walk over to my tarot shelf and pick a deck. So this week, we'll use a somewhat popular tarot deck that has got quite a bit of shelf space these days. I see this deck everywhere. It's called the Mystic Mondays Tarot, a deck for the modern mystic. If you're interested, I'll put a link in the show notes where you can buy the deck. It is a rather unique tarot deck, but in any case, we're not here to talk and review the deck so much as to think about what a specific card means with our intuition. So I'm just dumping these cards out here. These cards are interesting. They're kind of like foily-ish and super shiny, and they have like a silver edging to them. Gonna have to shuffle them in two separate stacks, probably. So if you're joining us for the first time with a tarot deck draw, this is not... I'm not divining the future, I'm not telling the future, I'm not manifesting anything, nothing like that. This is simply pulling a random card from a standard deck, 78 cards, and we're going to pull a random card, and we'll look at what that card means in its standard, traditionally prescribed meanings. And then what we'll do is we look at that meaning and we say, how does that... or does that, if at all, apply to my life today? And there's always a reason why these cards do connect with you, because it's very subjective in nature, right? Like, I'll shuffle the cards, I'll draw one, I'll tell you what it means, and then instantly, usually, you'll have a reason of why what I just said is applicable to some area of your life. That's why tarot readers are always... they always say, oh, they knew everything. It's like they knew. It's psychic. Well, it's not psychic so much as a person who's able to ask you questions and help you work through things. I mean, really, it's kind of like a psychological Rorschach in a weird kind of way. I've received some heat, by the way. I talk about tarot, but I think it's really the way Paul Case envisioned its use. I mean, it does have a mystic meaning if you want to take it even farther. You know, you can talk about the law of attraction and all those kinds of things, but that's not what we're doing here. I just want to draw a card and think about what it means. So I've shuffled the deck, cut it a few times, and we're just going to take one card right off the top. Oh, man. Great card. We got the Ace of Pentacles. Face up, too. Now, generally speaking, the Pentacles is associated with money. This is, like, pretty basic. The Ace of Pentacles, does it mean you're going to have tons of money? come into your bank account or in your person? Let's see. So what I want to do is give you the general meaning, and then I want to give you the meaning that comes out of the Mystic Mondays book, because maybe it's a little bit different, right? They advertise this deck as like a deck for the modern mystic. So upright, this card really is indicating that you might have a new opportunity of a new financial status, a new career. Something is going to manifest for you. Maybe it's not money, it's something, though. And it also represents abundance. And that word is so special. Abundance. So it's particularly when you think about affirmation work, we use the word abundance quite a bit because there's no mistaking what it means. A lot of something, right? So the Ace of the Pentacles is not unlike the aces of other things in tarot, whether that's wands or cups, swords. It's a new beginning card, a new opportunity. It's a card for potential, but more than potential, it's saying that something for you is on the way. That's about as divinatory as it's going to get. So depending on whether you want to correlate it to material things or finances, career, even physical health, you can certainly think about that. But it's also maybe a signal for you, like if you've been thinking about making a move to do something like these things, right? Like a new career, a new beginning, new opportunity. This is kind of like a little affirmation saying, go for it. Because as we know, if our minds are set to something, there's nothing we really can't achieve. I'm sure some of you are thinking about Marty McFly's dad, right? If you put your mind to something, there's nothing you can't do. And lastly, I want to say on these kind of traditional meanings for the card, the pentacle is always symbolizing wealth, really. The Ace of Pentacles is like, you know, wealth is coming, opportunity is knocking. So think about that, but maybe it's not always money. This could be mental opportunity, holistic wealth. Maybe this is a chance to get some real fulfillment. Maybe you just met somebody and the energy is awesome, and this is like, this is it. This is the relationship. Maybe this means you're going to get in line at the lodge. Maybe this means that new candidate who's petitioned is going to be a good fit. I mean, there's all kinds of things that you can think about what this might mean for you. And that's the beauty of it, is it's contemplative in nature and subjectively true. So the Mystic Mondays book actually describes the Ace of Pentacles as abundance, manifestation, and prosperity. Opportunities are abundantly available to you, especially in the material world. So it's kind of interesting, it goes with that basic money thing, but I don't want you guys to focus on that because we know that money isn't everything, right? Mental health and happiness and sharing time with people, these are all things that we would love to have in abundance, things that make us happy. So for our Craftsman Plus, think about that. I'll post a picture of the card in the Craftsman Plus group. If you feel like sharing anything about it, feel free to respond to the image. But that's it for this week. So I hope you had a great time listening, that you learned a little something, both about masonry and about ourselves. Until next week, stay on the level. For Whence Came You, I'm Robert Johnson. Take care.
You've been listening to Whence Came You, a Masonic podcast featuring research papers and discussions related to Freemasonry with your host, Brother Robert Johnson. Be sure to join us for our next edition.
WCY Media.